Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's the 21st of July 2018. I'm walking along the Staffordshire Worcestershire Canal and if you haven't heard any of these podcasts before, we very often do them whilst out taking a constitutional. I'm on my own today, but sometimes Anna is with me as a very able interlocutor and contributor, but today it's just me. It's good to be out and about amongst the trees, by the water, in the company of the ducks and the fish and the butterflies, because it's been one hell of a week, and the topic is what a week, what the fuck. A week ago, Friday the 13th, I think it was, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, engaged in a charm offensive by flying east from Washington, first to Brussels to talk with NATO leaders, secondly to the United Kingdom for talks with the Prime Minister Theresa May, and then on Monday he was in Helsinki having talks with Vladimir Putin, the President of the Russian Federation. And there's been a furore since that time over, well, caused, I would say, by Trump's flip-flopping and just inconsistency of utterance, I think is really what's at the root of the massive clamour that has resulted since. Now, the detail is available on the internet if you want to research it, and I'm not going to go too heavily into that because I'm aiming for something more general, more primordial, and I'm hoping I can get to the structures and processes that are implicit in the current situation. So, I've actually been just pouring information into the back of my brain this week. These are my sources. I watched the Trump-May press conference in its entirety, and also caught some of the commentary coming out through mainstream media like Channel 4 News, BBC. And the CNN and all those other atrocious wallers. A little bit of that. Also watched the Trump-Putin press conference in its entirety and caught some of the commentary and obviously got wind of the furore that ensued. This in the context of having watched over the previous week a documentary about the Vietnam War, which is on Netflix, long documentary, I'm not sure, maybe 10 episodes, over an hour, maybe 80 minutes a piece. There's a lot of material. It does seem fairly even-handed, but obviously there is a structure of themes which gives a certain bias to the story, and this is unavoidable, to be honest with you. The account of any complex reality like history or society is always underdetermined by the facts at your disposal. There is a hint of suspicion as well about this series in that one of the funders was David Koch of the Koch brothers, which it's the Koch brothers are amongst the richest people in the world. It's oil money, and they don't mind using it to influence the course of events. They, for instance, set up and funded the Tea Party in the US and have poured money into climate denial and publicising climate change denial. So I watched that. David Koch was only one of many contributors of funds, I have to add. And he did seem very even-handed. I mean, they spoke to people who'd fought in the war, American veterans, South Vietnamese veterans, North Vietnamese veterans, Viet Cong veterans. They also spoke to war opposition and members of the anti-war movement, people who'd evaded the draft, politicians of the day, of course. And there were lots of types of secret at the time talks between Johnson and his aides, President Johnson and President Nixon and Henry Kissinger and so on. It was very comprehensive, and I think it could be taken seriously. So in that context, having watched that documentary, which I have to say is a grueling experience in some ways. It's so monumental what happened in Vietnam from 1945 onwards into the 70s. That you can't be anything but soul-wrenched by the accounts from wherever they're coming. So in the context of that experience, then encountering this very current political unfolding, I also watched Prime Minister's Question Times in its entirety the following week, which was mostly about the Brexit fiasco in the UK, in which of course Trump has intervened in a sense, and in the course of which the Trump visit was mentioned. I should add that there were big demonstrations in the UK. At least 250,000 people had a kind of party, which was the right way to do it, I have to say. Because what we need is a carnival-esque to overcome this shit. If we're not going to go down the kind of plug hole of really destructive violence. Though I'm kind of hoping against hope that that won't occur, but I think at some point we're going to get civil unrest escalating. There is already considerable civil unrest across the world, but I think we're expecting an escalation. I also topped all this off by watching Al Gore's film of last year, 2017, called An Inconvenient Sequel. Now you might recall that Al Gore made a film in 2006 called An Inconvenient Truth, which really was an exposure of climate change. And the role of human industry, emissions of carbon-based effluents, carbon dioxide mainly, but also methane, on the climate, resulting in global warming. And Al Gore has made a sequel in 2017, so 11 years later, which focuses quite heavily on the Paris Climate Summit, which was in 2017. It was in April, I think. And which seemed to be a kind of a triumph of international agreement. One with difficulty, given the position of India, for instance, but the Third World, obviously, wanting to develop. And saying to the West, you had 150 years of pumping this stuff into the atmosphere, and that's why you've now got the high standard of living that you've now got. We've got villages with no water and no electricity, and you're expecting us to pick up the cost and not avail ourselves of coal and oil and all the rest of it. Anyway, shortly after there was an accord, President Trump withdrew the US, the biggest emitter of CO2, from the Paris Accord. And he's been nobbled by oil and coal interests and shale gas, fracking and all that. And he went on record as saying that the effort of the Paris conference was a complete waste of time. It was not like climate change isn't an urgent issue. So that kind of put a bit of context on it all for me as well. And I wanted to kind of pull this stuff together, in a sense, put sort of a lasso around it and tighten it a little and pull all these inputs together and see if I can discern the skeleton or the underlying system and structure to really make a more general point about political philosophy. And this is surprisingly difficult because even though it makes sense to me and I can see a shape and tendencies and you might say like proofs of pre-existing prejudice, it's quite difficult to express. It's quite difficult to not ramble in an amorphous way when trying to engage with all this stuff, all relevant, all current. Okay, the Vietnam War thing, but there's so many resonances. Between what happened then and what's happening now. Not apparent ones, nor obvious. There's no sort of war of that extent. You know, the US isn't embroiled in anything to the extent that it was embroiled in the Vietnam War. It's pretty embroiled. I mean, Trump drops one bomb every 12 minutes. Of course, Obama did the same. The golden boy, you know, he had blood on his hands like the rest of them. And one of the things that I was wanting to say when I was encountering this stuff, particularly the summits, the press conferences at the summits where the politicians are universally scoundrels. And I've changed my mind very slightly from that because I think there are some principled people who have a go. I think it's probably quite difficult not to be scuppered if you're too principled. If you enter a political career. But there are principled people, and people who really work very, very hard for the good of humanity in those difficult forums. So I want to say that. And perhaps I would name people who I think have got a bit of something about them as we go along. So that was going to be my thesis, and to some extent it is. Still, one of the theses that I'm going to try and establish. And through this talk. But there was another point which surfaced as I started taking notes and wondering about the order in which to unpick this material. And it, what emerged was a thesis that I keep returning to, but never quite managing to flesh out, that the world at large, as it moves into the future, is going through a phase, a historical phase, of in which the fragmentary forces outweigh cohesive forces. In other words, there's just a tendency to fragmentation that seems to be breaking out all over the place. I know some people attempted to put this down to the fulfilment of prophecies in Revelations, or some turbulence in the collective unconscious. But I really think that we need to look for material causes, whilst at the same time, I would say, not overdoing the superstructure base dualism that's found in crude Marxism, and which incidentally Engels repudiated. Engels said only in the last analysis, the very last analysis, is the base, the economic base, determinative of everything else. And I would want to say, you know, that ideas and debates and discourses and memes and tropes and theses are themselves material forces. Regarding the thesis that they're all fucking scoundrels, I was really taken by Al Gore's self-description in the 2017 film An Inconvenient Sequel as a recovering politician. That really grabbed me. Now, this guy, you should remember, he was Clinton's vice president, and he stood against George Bush for the presidency, and it was a very, very close run thing, and everything hung in the balance on which way Florida was going to go. And there was some question about the counting of the votes, the hanging chads controversy, if you remember that. Because they have a method of election whereby you push a sort of a perforation on a voting, on a ballot card, and there's a little bit of cardboard comes loose, and there's a hole, and that means that's a vote. Well, some of these things, they're called chads apparently, some of these little bits of cardboard are still hanging, so is that a vote for or a vote against? I think they're counted as, you know, unless the cardboard came away completely, it wasn't a vote for the person. And incidentally, George Bush's brother Jeb Bush was the governor of Florida at the time, and he waded in. And in the end, it went to the Supreme Court, I think, who voted in favour of Bush. So that's how Bush became the president. Al Gore was the best president the United States has never had, from what I can see. Though, of course, it may well have changed him the office, and he wouldn't have been the bloke that he is now. From what I can see, he's extremely principled and absolutely tireless campaigner for concerted action on the matter of global warming. Tireless, and from what I can see, somebody worthy of admiration. So you could have had this guy and you got Bush. But there you go. Oh, life's little ironies. Anyway, he describes himself now as a recovering politician. And you could see that the Trump May meetings. And there was all sorts of live streaming of the helicopter landing at Blenheim Palace, and I call this the kind of men with funny hats syndrome. And there's a lot of band playing, they play the various national anthems, and Trump inspects these chaps, red coats, which is ironic, isn't it? These ceremonial guards in their red uniforms with the big stupid hats, bearskins they're called, and they're big furry black things, about 2 foot tall, all preposterous and Ruritanian and ridiculous. And it's just, I don't know, the pomposity of pomp, and you realise that the people like that live in a fucking bubble, you know. Trump comes in his aeroplane and he flies it to and fro in the United Kingdom to his various engagements in an helicopter. He doesn't see the 250,000 people having a party in order to repudiate his odious values in the streets. Because there's a huge debate in this country at that point on whether it was rude. Because they did float this kind of like naff balloon of a Trump effigy wearing a nappy, like Trump the baby, trying to make a play of his infantilism. I don't know. Who cares? To be honest, you know, let's insult the motherfucker, you know. And free speech. So that becomes an item of debate, you know. You've got all these distractions. The stupid pomp. The ridiculous Ruritanian uniforms. The whole business of the symbols of power that have to sort of play out. I mean, prior to coming to the UK, he's pretty well slagging off the efforts to sort the Brexit out, and because there have been mass resignations and all sorts. And then, of course, when he gets here, he's like, he's up Theresa May's bloody jacksie, you know, heaping on the praise, doing the diplomacy. So what does he fucking think, you know? If anything, one is inclined to think that he don't know what he thinks. He just flip-flops. All that matters is whether you like people or not, whether they like you or not. Some kind of like art of the deal shit. And for him, everybody's a competitor. And what matters is winning. Oh, incidentally, I should mention that I also watched on Netflix a probably biased account of Trump's life. Probably biased, but then there was loads of footage. He's always been in the spotlight all his life. So, you know, you can hear what the guy says. And he says that what matters to him is competition and winning. That's it. Winning is what matters. So, compromise isn't really in his book, you know. Though, of course, he has to appear as though it is. He has to appear to be making moves for peace, towards peace. And they're trying to push a story that Trump got this thing going with Kim Jong-il in North Korea, and that Kim Jong-il will stop pursuing the nuclear option, and that Trump should win the Nobel Peace Prize for that. Oh, well, I'll tell you, let's wait and see. You know, great if he's done it, but it strikes me as unlikely. So, you can see why Al Gore would describe himself as a recovering politician. I think he means recovering from the stress, just recovering from the pressure of appearances, I would call it. The pressure towards sophistry and deceit and secrecy. And what actually detest most about politicians is the willingness to dispose of people's lives as though they were numbers on a spreadsheet. Now, the Vietnam film brings this out very emphatically. You can listen to the types of Johnson's private phone conversations and the types of Nixon's private conversations. And these people are so removed, they're so in their authoritarian symbolic bubble, they're so corrupted by power, that the real people, the real life people, who are getting their bollocks shot off, or are coming back in body bags in these symbolic wars, or wars over raw materials, which benefit the profits of the corporations. Those real flesh and blood people are simply not in the picture as flesh and blood. And that is utterly disgusting. This actually came very much into prominence last week from a really unexpected quarter. Now I like to get primary sources. I don't want to rely on the Daily Mail or the Guardian or for the material that I interpret as I try and figure out the world. It's interesting what they say, but we have to bear in mind that the mainstream media is owned by a handful of billionaires. And it was in this vein I was watching the parliamentary proceedings, and a Tory MP stood up, Anna Soubry, and absolutely laid into the Rees-Mogg crowd, this group of Tory hard Brexiteers. They want basically nothing to do with the EU, and they don't want the sort of compromise and Byzantine attempts to retain some connection with the EU that the May cabinet discussions, the so-called Chequers agreement and the white paper came out last week, which incidentally I've been reading. So these guys tried to scupper, even though they'll claim otherwise, Chequers agreements. This Anna Soubry went mad at Mogg, Rees-Mogg, who was a bloke with inherited money and all the rest of it. And she said, it's all very well for you lot, with your gold-plated pensions and your inherited wealth. My constituents are going to be losing their jobs and da da da. You know. And she was incandescent. And she sounded like Red Ken or somebody, or or the Beast of Bolsover, or George Galloway, Tory. And then some commentator, some YouTube commentator, again another Tory, a Tory in the Mogg camp, the hard Brexit camp, saying it was disgraceful and unparliamentary language, and that leave means leave. Which is complete bollocks, you know. Leave is any number of things. Leave is an infinity of number of possibilities. Leave means leave, don't mean anything. And it shows what kind of fucking simpletons a lot of politicians are. Now, this might seem like a digression, but I've been reading The Sophist by Plato, in which Plato tries to figure out what a sophist is, and perhaps in contrast to what a philosopher is or what a statesman is. Plato also wrote at the same time a book called The Statesman. He didn't write a book called The Philosopher, but at the conclusion of The Sophist, through a very sort of quite rarefied epistemological and metaphysical argument, or quasi-argument, is that a sophist is an imitator of a philosopher, but who is actually in the acquisitive game of earning money by teaching rhetorical skills, rather than the creative game of philosophy proper, which attempts to arrive at some kind of truth or wisdom, more accurately, the love of wisdom. The sophist doesn't love wisdom. But as the thing is, he has an imitation, he has the surface imitation of a rigorous thinker and an honest thinker. But really, he's in it for the money. And I think on that basis, you know, most of our statesmen are sophists. They're kind of not, they're not very intelligent if they think that the slogan is more useful than the reasoned argument. Now, obviously, they are in the business of persuasion, they need to get votes and all the rest of it. Though, in the US, more than in the UK, but in the UK also, as I'll mention in a moment, what really counts is money, the money you can throw at a campaign. Al Gore, in this 2017 film, said a democracy has been hacked, and he means hacked by money, by the corporate pack. And it is actually, you know, the Koch brothers and all these people can throw billions at it, and there's no law preventing donations. There's no upper limit. In the UK, we do have kind of laws that say you've got to spend fairly equal amounts of money and the upper limits on campaign funding. Now, in that context, the Brexit referendum, whenever it was, a couple of years ago now, 2016, had two official bodies whose funding was scrutinised by the autonomous authority that watches over campaign spending in politics. There was a Leave campaign, official Leave campaign, official Remain campaign. And it now seems that the Leave campaign exceeded the spending allowance and by pooling with another organisation and having access to their funds. Now, there's arguments about whether that really happened or not, but anyway, they've been fined. The Leave campaign's been fined, I think £61,000, for breaking the rules. I mean, does that make the referendum void? I mean, I dare say that would put the cat amongst the pigeons if anybody started chasing that seriously. And the police have been given the papers, so it might look as though there'll be some prosecutions on that one. So, the UK has got these rules about spent expenditure, but still it's not immune from the power of the corporations. And the British state is completely entangled with the corporations and corporate interests. I found this out when just investigating the well-being industry. It really is kind of shocking when you start digging around the network, the cabal, the old boy network, you know. This cabalism is rife in the UK state. In America, it's all the more upfront, and there are no limits. It's refreshing in this context to see that there's a new breed of politicians who are actually taking a pledge not to accept corporate money, corporate PAC money, they call it. Amongst whom I would mention Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a 28-year-old, who just got nomination in opposition to old right-wing Democratic fart on a sort of a Bernie Sanders type platform, social justice, healthcare, education. They call it socialism in America. But she seems pretty cool. And I think in maybe 10, 15 years' time, I think she'll get into a presidential race at some point if she can kind of carry on. So it's refreshing to see this is the refusal of the corporate money. Okay, friends, I'm at home now and I just want to round up the podcast. It did finish somewhat abruptly due to the SD card in the recorder being full up, so I kind of lost a couple of minutes. But there was nothing significant further, and it was time to stop anyway, because I'd reached the city centre and
It's rather noisy and not suitable for recording. I do intend to do a part two, which I shall record tomorrow. And part two will deal with the theme of fragmentation. If you've listened to these podcasts, you'll find that I frequently allude to the idea that the state of the world can be captured by this idea that things are falling apart. There's a fragmentary force abroad, pretty well around the world. And what I want to do in this second podcast in the Trump, May and Putin story is to utilise the material that I've investigated over the last week, deriving from the political events of the last week, to further illustrate this thesis that indeed fragmentation is the characteristic of our time. I intend to relate fragmentation to material forces, but I also intend to argue that ideas, memes, thoughts, cultural movements are themselves material forces to some extent. So I don't want to go into a crude Marxist dichotomy between superstructure and base, following Engels on that matter. So thank you for listening, and I hope that this has been interesting enough for you to want to listen to part two. So once again, thanks for listening.